Chapter 16 Countdown. The currents of real space and the vagaries of the warp had condensed a vast cloud of material in the gravity pit of the Rimworld marginals. The few pale suns fluttered like candles in the deep ditch of blackness and shone their thin light upon a prodigious pall of flotsam. At the place known as Salvation's Reach, the junk belt was at its thickest, a monumental agglomeration of debris, almost 200,000 kilometres deep at its thickest. Part of it was planetary debris, rocks, dust, and other mineral effluent forming solid masses like gallstones or bezoars. Some of it, however, was artificial in origin. There was tech. There were machine parts. There were the hulks and shells of space machines, ships, barges, carriers, void habitats, supermassives like some graveyard of wrecks. Craft lost and foundered down through the ages had washed up at Salvation's Reach. And there they had gathered, collected, mangled each other and, through the action of decay and gravitic pressure, fused into a great knot of material, accumulating like a metal reef. Some of it was imperial. Some of it was not. Some of it was of human or human derivative manufacture. Some of it was not. Some ancient scraps, the carcasses of lost imperial vessels, were relics of Terran tech that had not been seen for so long they were no longer recognisable to the Adeptus Mechanicus. Old template patterns, unrecoverably deformed, lurked in the silent residue. Some of it was so old, so worn, so alien, it was impossible to discern the source or original function. Mechanicus expeditions had been mounted down the years, along with inquisitorial probe missions and countless endeavours of salvage and scavenging. But the marginals were unstable, inhospitable and remote, and the secrets cast away there were too demanding to recover. The Armaduke, adjusting its course by gentle, real space burns, slowly crept into this increasingly crowded environment, heading for the solid, planet-sized nugget at its heart. During the Beatti's original crusade of liberation across the Sabbat worlds, the marginals had been the site of a significant fleet action, a turning point in the fortunes of the Imperium that had put the interests of the sanguinary worlds and their Archon into retreat. Legend said that Salvation's Reach had been the name of the Imperial flagship, a flagship that had stood its ground under astonishing enemy fire and died with all hands, holding the line long enough for the Saints' victory to be achieved. Legend said that the debris accumulated in the junk belt was the wreckage of that titanic fleet action, the battlefield litter of one of the Rim's greatest real space engagements. Other legends said that Salvation's Reach was the name of a planet destroyed during that void fight. Different legends said it was the name of the archenemy supermassive that had finally been scuppered just minutes before it target-locked the Saints' cruiser. In Spiker's opinion, none of the legends were any better than half-truths. The debris field included a great deal of space war junk, but it was the accumulated residue of thousands of fights accidentally clustered here, not the devastation left by one fight at this location. Besides, there were too many tech types, too many species variants. Cogitation analysis showed vast differences in the ages and decay of debris samples. Some pieces of scrap were just a few hundred years old. Some were a few hundred thousand. Spiker took the helm himself. This was rare, but his bridge officers did not question it. The insertion run required a shipmaster's finesse. It needed to be fast and quiet, but their speed was limited by manoeuvrability in the junk zone. Most of the junk could be dealt with by shields, but some pieces were two or three times the size of the Armaduke and required evasion. Obliterating pathway targets was an emergency option only. Spiker did not want to draw attention to their approach by disintegrating a looming junk obstacle with battery fire. Spiker was also letting cold momentum take them in whenever possible. With an expert touch, he was allowing the Armaduke to drift from one corrective burn to the next, almost to the point where the old ship began to slide and tumble. Just one more piece of space machine wreckage, drifting towards the core. It was an artful simulation. If the forces dwelling within the metal core of Salvation's Reach had external sensors or detector grids, the Armaduke's approach would not be betrayed by non-ballistic trajectory. Spiker kept his propulsion systems simmering, ready to breathe and squirt power at short notice to turn the ship or avoid some spinning mass. Gaunt's adjutant, Beltane, had arrived on the bridge and taken up a station near the shipmaster, with access to the strategium. Spiker paid him little attention. He seemed a bright enough man, but he was just another drone, and Spiker was sure he'd have difficulty picking him out of a squad in a day or two. What he did pay attention to was the data that Beltane had brought and loaded, with the help of the hololithic artificers, into the main strategium display. It was the most recent schematic of Salvation's Reach, extracted by a mnemonic probe from the mind of Gaunt's prisoner. This man, this Etagor, had been probed, interviewed and scanned on a daily basis since his capture. As it had been explained to Spiker, the man was a defector, a triple defector. It wasn't clear, but it seemed that the Etagor had once been an Imperial Guardsman. He had been captured and turned by the forces of the archenemy, and drafted, because of his training and expertise, into the Archon's frightful cadre, known as the Blood Pact. Later, for reasons Spiker didn't even want to consider, Mabon Etagor had renounced that allegiance and broken his pact, joining the Sons of Sek, another martial fraternity. The Sons, as their name suggested, were a consanguineous echelon, sworn to the Magister Anak Wanar Sek, the Archon's principal ally and lieutenant. He was a troubled soul, clearly, a restless heart. How, Spiker wondered, did one man contain so much within one lifetime? Bonded into three different institutions that were ordinarily served unto death. Perhaps the original Imperial conditioning had won out in the end, driving Mabon back to the Emperor despite everything. If that were true, it was the most stupendous effort of fortitude and devotion. If it were false, they were heading to their deaths. Mabon had come to the Imperial side with vital data. He knew that the intelligence and insight he possessed would be the only things that would keep him alive and prevent summary execution. He had data, and he had the means to interpret that data, despite the psionic scans and mind probes. He had kept certain things obscure. He was smart enough to know that he had to release the information he carried slowly. His life would become redundant the moment he gave it all up. He protected his mind through the conditioned resolve of someone who had both taken and broken the bloody pact, and through a variety of engrammatic codings. Before quitting the service of the archenemy, he had layered into his mind data concerning the Salvation's Reach facility using a cerebral encryptor, information that could not simply be stripped out, but could only be recovered by methodical and repeated meditation. Since his capture, he had been slowly remembering and building a picture for his Imperium handlers. The core of Salvation's Reach was a hulk habitat of considerable size, converted for use as a weapons development facility and manufactory. This facility had originally been set up by the Magister Heritor Asphodel, under the instruction of the then Archon Nadzibar. It was remote and inconspicuous, and allowed for the enhancement and testing of weapon systems, be they systems developed by the mad genius Asphodel, recovered Xeno artifacts or gifts from the demented Chaos gods. Nadzibar had fallen on Balhaut. Asphodel had perished by Gaunt's hand on Vergast. The facility remained, inherited by the Anarch Sek. He was using it to strengthen his hand and develop weapon support for his sons. It was an arsenal, a stockpile, a laboratory. According to Mabon, Sek felt he should have taken on the mantle of Archon after Nadzibar. The Anarch resented Gower's rise to eminence, and, though obliged by the martial politics of the sanguinary worlds to pact with him, had little respect for Gower's command of the campaign since Balhaut. Sick envied Gower's authority, and he envied Gower's revolutionarily disciplined personal army, the Blood Pact. He press-ganged Blood Pact warriors like Mabon to help him create his own force, the Sons of Sek, and set out to prove that he deserved the mantle of Archon. It was a compelling claim. The previous decade had shown Urlok Gaur to be a savage chieftain, capable of extreme brutality even by the standards of the ruinous powers. His Blood Pact was certainly supremely effective. He was also sloppy and lacked strategic insight. His blunt and ferocious style of war-making had lost him as much as he had gained. It had driven him back all the way to the Erinnys group in a series of catastrophic defeats, and only there had he managed to resist Makaroth's impetus. In contrast, the Anarch Sek, a far more ingenious and mercurial tactician, had performed superbly along the Crusade's second front, securing and holding on to the Cabal systems in the face of the Imperium's most determined efforts. It was entirely reasonable to expect that if, by means of facilities such as Salvation's Reach, Sek could show he was a better leader than Gower, more able, better served and better equipped, the tribes of the sanguinary worlds might oust Gower and look to Sek to take the crown of the Archon and break the stagnation. Two consequences were clear. Sek's ambition had to be stopped. The Anarch was so capable that, if finally granted the supreme authority of Archon, he would make the continued prosecution of the Sabbat World's Crusade unviable. The Imperium would be forced to retreat and perhaps suspend operations entirely. More particularly, what better result could the Imperium hope for than to have the fragile partnership of Archon and Anarch fracture, and for Gower and Sek to turn upon each other? From time to time, Spica glanced at the slowly rotating schematic of Salvation's Reach projecting up from the main table of the Strategium display. As they approached, actual detector readings overmapped and refined the plans. So far, Mabon's intelligence was remarkably precise. Spica wondered how precise. What might be missing? What might have changed? Mabon claimed to have visited the facility three times as part of the Sun's force, and his memory engram of the structure had been copied from confidential files in the palace of the Anarch. Details might have altered since then. Range scanning had already identified the three surface sites, pre-selected for the strike points, Alpha, Beta and Gamma. A further question occurred to the shipmaster. It was actually one that had nagged him for days, and which he had been reluctant to voice. The mission's credibility rested on the belief that Mabon Etagor had defected back to the Imperial cause, that after taking a path from which there should have been no return. He had rediscovered his loyalty to the Imperium, and brought to them, as an act of contrition and recompense, the means to cripple and disarm their greatest present foe. What if his defection had simply been back to the Blood Pact, and he was now manipulating the Imperium into doing Urlok Gaur's dirty work by taking out his chief rival? Gaunt buckled on his belt, checked his bolt pistol and slotted it into the holster. He finished buttoning up his tunic and then started to fasten on his sword belt. Madalena came out of the bedchamber. She had dressed in some expensive, lightweight and ornate partial combat armour.
"You're not coming along," said Gaunt. "I know, but if the fight spills this way, I want to be ready."
She looked at Gaunt's power sword. It was clamped in its rack on the top of the locker, ready to fit into the scabbard. The power sword of Hieronymo Sondar, an emblem of Vervunhive, and the great Vergast victory against the ruinous powers.
"You should show him that," she said.
"Felix?"
"Yes, You should show him that sword. Explain what you did to get it.
He already knows, said Gaunt.
Of course he does, she said. But that doesn't mean it's not important for him to hear you tell it.
Gaunt took down the sword, activated its field briefly, felt the throb of its power, then deactivated it and sheathed it.
I'll bear that in mind, he said.
There was a knock at the cabin door. Gaunt had begun to enjoy the way Madalena's hand went for a weapon at the slightest cue, hardwired to fight and protect. Get in the bedroom, he told her. She raised her eyebrows.
I really don't think we have time, she said.
He laughed, though it felt like too serious a time. She got up and disappeared. Golkalia was waiting at the door in full kit, weapon slung. His salute let Gaunt know it was an official visit.
Regiment battle ready and correct, sir, he said. Strike Alpha is assembled on the main excursion deck. Strike Beta awaits you in lateral hold 16. Strike Gamma is assembled in lateral hold 39. Thank you, Major. Time on target? Estimate is now 5:16, sir.
Have the shipmaster informed we stand ready.
I will.
Anything else to report, Gol? Kalia shook his head.
The mood's good, he said. I mean, everything considered, all the build-up, the extremity of it. I think the ghosts have been out of the fight too long. For some, it's been so long they thought they'd never march again. We need this.
We need to win this, said Gaunt.
Of course, sir. That's always true. In the grand scheme of things, we need to win this. But for us, for the regiment, we just need to do it, win or lose. We have to get bloody again, or we'll be good for nothing.
Gaunt nodded. Point taken. I think we're ready to get bloody. Kalia nodded at Gaunt's power sword.
You might let the boy take a look at that sometime.
Gaunt frowned sharply. Kalia held up his hands peaceably.
I know, Kalia said. I'm hardly the one to be handing out advice on being an effective father.
It's not that, said Gaunt. Have you been talking to someone?
No.
You're not the first person to say that to me. Kalia shrugged.
The ghosts haven't taken to the boy yet, sir, he said. It's a little strange for them, to be honest. But I think they will. I think they'll respect him because he's yours. But I think you'll need to show them you respect him too.
Gaunt didn't reply. He put on his cap and picked up his gloves.
I'll walk down with you and inspect the assemblies, he said.
Kalia looked back into the apparently empty cabin and pointed with his chin.
Aren't you going to say goodbye first? He asked.
Gaunt was forced into a half-smile.
Not much gets past you, does it, Gaul?
Kalia laughed.
I'm not disapproving, sir. Not my place. And she's a handsome woman.
She'll be here when I get back, said Gaunt. He closed the cabin door behind him and set off along the hallway with Kalia.
That's what I like to hear, said Kalia. Confidence!
That she'll still be there?
No, he said. That you know you're coming back.
The sheer scale of the debris mass became clearer as they approached. The Armajuke was just a speck amongst billions of specks surrounding the vast bolus of material. Salvation's Reach was a planetoid, a veritable planet, except that its mass was not spherical. It was a colossal, lumpen ingot, flattening out to a disc form at its extremities, where gravity had moulded it. Through the outer scopes and telepicts, Spiker resolved surface detail akin to some orc ships he'd encountered. Except it was put together with less precision. He saw a compressed jumble of mechanical material, like machines mangled and intermingled by an industrial compactor. There were canyons and ravines, sharp peaks and plateaus, deep fissures and almost smooth planes of hull fabric. Swimming through the dense swarms of loose junk, the Armajuke found itself slipping through floating sticks of promethium and other liquids and particulates, substances that had seeped out of the main mass and bled into space. Lateral holds 16 and 39 were situated about two-thirds of a kilometre apart on the port side of the Armadyke. They both had large, armoured outer hatches equipped with atmospheric fuel generators. Prior to departure from Menazoid Sigma, the hatch surrounds of both hold apertures had been reinforced and built out with vulcanised buffer collars. Spica initiated the final approach. Apart from orbital dry docks, the Armadyke had never been positioned this close to a larger object. It felt counterintuitive to him, though every system was green. A shift ship was built for the freedom of the open void, not to snuggle in against the outer layers of a megastructure, like a tick in the skin of a grox. Spica had been obliged to cancel and mute all the proximity alarms and fundamentally adjust the ship's inertial stability to counteract the gravimetric load. The ship itself seemed to sense that the manoeuvre was wrong. Like Spica, the Armadyke was reluctant, as if it felt it was being deliberately crashed into the surface of a planet. The hull frame creaked and groaned uneasily. Burn corrections became hair's breadth subtle, with a dull and protracted rumble and an eerie screech of scraping hull that shuddered through the ship and seemed to issue from some immense, echoing cavity. The Armadyke settled against the skin of the Reach. Spica killed the drives and correction thrusters. He activated the magnetic clamps and inertial anchors. He turned to Beltane. "Inform your commander that the mission may now proceed," he said. In lateral hold 16 and 39, artificer crews scrambled towards the outer doors, erecting protective screens and baffles around what would be their workspace. Several of them waited for the indicator lights in the control panels of the atmospheric fuel generators to show green. In order to assure the results, they anointed the panels and uttered the correct propitiations. Processors hummed and throbbed. Machinery was rolled forwards in front of the hatch gates, and power cables were played out. Servitor crews advanced and stood ready with pressure hoses that fed from the water reservoirs inside the Armadyke's hull skin, water that was dark and sludgy with ice. Behind the protective barriers in the main body of each hold space, assembled with their equipment and weapons, the strike teams sat and waited. Some spoke quietly, some rechecked their kit or specialist equipment, some muttered blessings to themselves or smoked low sticks, some caught catnaps. Some watched the artificers at work. The ghosts were dubious. This wasn't their field of specialism. Every now and then, some pained metallic squeal would echo through the ship, a grinding shriek from where the cruiser's hull rested against the bulk of the scrap metal world they had docked against. Ghosts jumped, made the sign of the Aquila, and looked around for the source of the noise. Just over 20 long, edgy minutes after the Armadyke snuggled itself in against the Reach, telltales flashed green in lateral 16 and 39 almost simultaneously. Gaunt had just arrived in 16, where Strike Beta had assembled. At a nod from the chief artificer, Gaunt took a handset from the waiting Vox officer and called through to Major Pasha in lateral 39.
"We have green here," she reported. "Field stabilised," Gaunt agreed. "Give the order to open your hatch." "The Emperor protects," Petrushevskaya replied.
Gaunt looked at the chief artificer.
"Open," he said.
The chief artificer nodded, turned and signalled to the bay gallery where cargo officers activated the hatch gate controls. There was a gentle clatter. Gaunt turned and saw that Strike Beta had risen to its feet en masse, weapons ready. He knew full well that an almost identical scene was playing out in lateral 39. There was a thump, a hiss of compression seal pistons, a whirr of retractor motors, and the hold's massive outer hatch began to open. Effectively, the hull side wall of the bay slid to one side. Light from the hold revealed what was behind it. Another wall, blackened and scabbed, worn by age and scoured by the void, lumpy and corroded, fused and blistered. This was the outer skin of the Reach. Alarm lights flashed on and off, warning that the atmospheric field surrounding the docking buffers was fighting to maintain a seal. There was no danger of explosive decompression into the hard vacuum outside, but Gaunt could feel the sharp breeze of the slow leaks, air rushing out around the inexact seal. "Can you stabilise it?" he asked. The artificers were already making adjustments to the shape and size of the atmospheric field via the control station. Further prayers of efficacy were offered to the machine spirits. Slowly, the lights stopped winking and the sucking air leaks died away. Silence. Silence apart from the very distant creak and squeal of metal on metal. Gaunt walked past the protective screens right up to the face of the Reach's exposed outer skin. It was ugly, like blackened metal scar tissue, ridged and contorted beside the dank but clean-holed structures of the Armaduke. Gaunt took off his glove, put out his bare hand and touched the alien metal. It was only just beginning to warm from the ambient heat of the hold's atmosphere. Gaunt felt an eternity of void cold, the legacy of airless dark. He felt the chill contours of threats and promises. He looked at the chief artificer. "Prepare to cut it," he ordered. The Vox officer was standing by. Gaunt relayed the same order to Major Pasha and then switched channels to speak to Shipmaster Spiker. "Bridge, Shipmaster, please signal Strike Alpha to launch. The order is given." "Understood." Launch Artificer Goodchild placed the Voxhorn back on its hook, stood up and walked down the metal gangplank into his supervision gallery. The brass control board had been purified and blessed, and the votive seals, threads of inscribed paper attached by wax and red ribbons, had been removed from the lever controls and dials. Goodchild had only to say one word. His servitors and technicians set to work. Greased pistons began to elevate sections of the deck. Exhaust vents clattered open. The main and secondary lighting systems of the principal excursion deck dimmed to cold blue and yellow hazard lamps began to flash. There was a pressure drop as the main air gates and outer space doors opened, hinging out and away like the petals of a flower. The atmospheric envelope adjusted accordingly. Field strength peaked. Voices murmured all around him. The augmetic drone of servitors mindlessly pronouncing streams of technical calibration figures and flight crew adepts monotonously repeating the catechisms of service and duty. On the main deck below, gangs of ratings, many of them bulk-grown ab-human serfs, hauled away the cable lines and mooring wires, cranking them into the underdeck drums. The first six boats on the primary landing were laden and waiting, lift systems running. Through-deck hoists were already lifting the next wave of craft up from the parking hangar. It was unusual for small craft like Arvis lighters and Falco atmospherics to be hoisted or repositioned with personnel on board, but the shipmaster had expressed to Goodchild the importance of rapid launch. Laden with LAS men and assault equipment, the landing craft were being loaded into the launch platform like ammunition into a gun. The first craft lifted and began to accelerate towards the space doors. It was the heavyweight giant that Goodchild had seen aboard at Tavis Sun, a martial brute in the colours of the Silver Guard. Its pattern designation was Caestus, an assault ram vehicle of ancient Adeptus Astartes design, a machine built for boarding actions. Its rear burners lit hot yellow as it cleared the air gate, and then turned wild green as it slipped through the hazy edge of the atmospheric field into hard space. Behind it came the first of the assault carriers, Arvis pattern craft, both long and standard body variants, followed by four Falco boats. They launched in pairs, their engines making shriller, thinner sounds compared to the guttural throb of the Caestus. The engine sounds died away as soon as the small ships left the atmospheric field. The second launch wave was already sliding onto the ramp. Goodchild walked back to his Vox station and lifted the horn. "We have launch conditions," he reported. "Launching in progress." Vox Mike held ready in his hand. Beltane watched the shipmaster and the other senior bridge officers gathered round the glowing strategium console. On the hololith, little patches of lights were spitting out of the imaged Armaduke and whipping away information around the seam of the Reach structure. Spica had brought the resolution up, so not all of the Reach was being projected. Beltane saw the little clusters of fast lights, like neon seeds zipping across the ragged topography of the Reach's hull away from the Armaduke, flying very low, hugging the terrain to avoid detection. Beltane noticed the way Spica was drumming his fingertips in the handrail of the strategium as he watched. There was a slightly sour odour on the bridge, the smell of adrenaline. It wasn't just the stressed crew, bio-wired into the neurosystems of the ship. The abhumans and serfs were reacting in tension too. The ship itself was nervous. "Strike Alpha, 8 minutes to target," intoned one of the seniors. Spica nodded. His fingertips drummed. At the helm of the Caestus, pilot servitor Terek 810 maintained a steady course. His biomechanical hands rested on the helm controls, though he was operating the heavy machine through the neural impulse linkage of his augmetic plugs. Manual control was for emergencies. The chambers of his hearts thrilled to the output of the engines either side of him. Forward view through the small window port was restricted. He was following a tight course through the broken geography of the target area's surface plotted by AUSPEX and displayed via hololithic router. The Caestus was leading the assault flight, twisting around slopes of junk, banking over torn pylons, hugging the floors of metal ravines and chasms, even flying under accidentally created bridges and outcrops of shredded machinery. Rear-projecting AUSPEX showed the troop landers tight on his tail, following his lead. Terek 810 was also detecting steady vital readings from the three individuals strapped into the inertial suppression clamps in the armoured compartments of the twin hull booms below and ahead of him. The vitals were impossibly slow, as though the individuals were so calm they were almost asleep. Terek 810 woke up the weapons servitors, and their fragile little sinus rhythms lit up alongside the three slow, heavy pulses.
4 minutes,
the pilot servitor intoned, each word clean and separate, each word significant. In lateral 16, Gaunt watched the artificers roll the Hades breaching drill into position. Its vast cutting head was just a hair's breadth from the face of the Reach's exposed hull. The last few blessings were being made over its systems. The chief artificer glanced at Gaunt. Gaunt held up three fingers. 3 minutes remaining. The Arvus was buffeting hard. Freak electromagnetics plagued the ravines and canyons, scoring the metal skin of Salvation's Reach. It wasn't the most pleasant ride Gaul Collier had ever known. The cargo hold of an Arvus lighter offered no visibility and precious little comfort. The bare metal box had been fitted out to afford bench seating for combat-ready troops and enough room to stow their equipment. They were strapped in along facing rows, backs to the hull, feeling every jolt and shake down their spines. There were no windows, just a half-slit through to the tiny helm compartment. The Arvus was a workhorse, designed for loading and lugging. Comfort and luxury had never been considerations. Kalia shifted in his seat. He had his LAS rifle braced upright between his knees, and the harness of the rebreather mask buckled around his neck. Because of the way the boarding shields had been stowed, there was scarcely any room for his feet. He was right by the rear drop hatch, ready to lead the way out. He looked back along the cargo hold. Members of C Company were enduring the ride, most looking straight ahead or down at the deck. Cowber and Werson, Derren, Neath, Stark and the flame trooper Lies, Bull and McCann with the .30. Facing him with his shoulder to the hatch was Rerval, Collier's company adjutant.
2 minutes, said Rerval. We're almost there. Yes, said Collier. Things will be so much better once they're shooting at us.
The liquid dripping from the readied hoses stank of promethium and rust. The smell reminded Bandour of the rain that used to fall across Haas West and the fortress tops of Vervenhive. Dirty rain, soiled by the metal factories and engineering fab plants. He walked the length of the lateral 39, reviewing the squads of Strike Gamma. The ghosts were drawn up behind the line of protective barriers. There was edginess. Half of the assembled strength was Vergast, the influx from Major Petrushevskaya's company. Despite their common bonds and origins, these troops had not fought alongside the ghosts before, and they had yet to prove themselves worthy of the name. He nodded to Vivo, to Noah Vadim, to Polo, and Niriam, and Wagner. He stopped to speak to Sina and Arilla, with their heavy .30. He paused to exchange a joke with Spetnin, Major Pasha's number two. Mags was waiting with Haller, Raglon and the first wave shooters, Mert, Questa and Nessa. The marksmen carried their long las pieces over their shoulders. The whole group was watching Dower's adjutant, Moore, who was kneeling beside his voxcaster, listening.
All set, Dower asked. I've been for months now, replied Haller.
Dower smiled. He'd known Haller a long time. They'd come up through Vervenhive defence together. Haller undoubtedly recognised the rain smell of Haas West too. Haller had never had the drive and ability to excel like Dower, but Dower knew how hard Haller had been training in the past few months to secure the leadership of one of Gamma's clearance teams. Major Pasha joined them with Hark. The commissar was setting his cap just right, ready for business. Dower noticed that the heavy leather holster of Hark's plasma pistol was unbuttoned.
1 minute, said Moore.
The lighting in the Caestus's hull boom compartments turned red. Secured in their clamps, Holofernesse, Saraph and Edwine barely acknowledged the notification. But steel-cased fists locked around the grips of weapons. Pilot servitor Terek 810 checked his pick screens. The final few seconds of data were streaming in, with actual real-time AUSPECT scans and detection results superseding the predicted data and less accurate distance scans. The primary ingress target had, after detailed analysis, been designated prior to launch. It was a location that appeared on the distant resolutions to be a major air gate or docking hatch, one of the main entries to the Salvation's Reach facility. Now, as they were closing, the systems were showing the hatch to be a largely defunct ruin, part of the junked architecture. Thermal and energetic traces were showing a smaller airgate structure, still large enough for bulk cargo handling, to be the most recently and regularly used. This second gate was down and to the left of what the plan insisted should be the primary ingress target. Density penetration scans showed the primary to be both reinforced and backfilled with rubble and debris. Terek 810 didn't make a conscious decision. The pilot servitor processed the revised data and adjusted his mission profile for optimum effect. A deft manual adjustment, 16 seconds from contact, steered the Caestus down and to the left. The secondary air gate locked up as the newly selected target, fixed in the crosshairs dead centre of the data plates and monitors. It looked like a cliff face, a cliff face made of dark, stained and pitted metal. Terek 810 triggered the afterburners. The short-fire rocket burners lit, and the Caestus lurched as though it had been kicked from behind by a giant. 8 seconds from the cliff face, the missile batteries mounted on the Caestus's wings unloaded their blistering shoals of micro-missiles. At the same time, the Magna Melta cannon mounted between the ram booms discharged. The radiant blast of the heat cannon puckered and warped the metal cliff face. The airgate hatch structure bubbled and liquefied, spurting a geyser of white-hot blobs into the void, like silt disturbed from the bed of a pond. The epicentre of the hit was left as an oozing sore of white-hot metal, a glowing crater that almost penetrated the reinforced hull skin. Less than a second later, the spread of Fire Fury micro-warheads impacted, a saturation strike that annihilated the already compromised fabric of the airgate. There was a light flash which strobed ultra-rapidly with the multiple detonations, and the gate shredded. First blown in, and then instantly ejected as the pressurised bay behind it abruptly decompressed. In the last few seconds, the Caestus found itself flying into a swirling and exhaling fireball and a storm of debris that hailed off its prow shields and armoured hull, nicking and gouging and scraping. Terek 810 held the course firm, despite the monumental turbulence. Both visually blinded and scanner-blanked by the blast's extreme energy flare, Terek 810 fired the heat cannon twice more anyway, lancing devastating energy into the open wound of the blown-out docking bay. The last seconds ran out. Their flight time was used up, with less than a single second of variation between predicted passage duration and actual elapsed time. The Caestus was inside Salvation's reach. It punched through the expanding fireball, burning into the hold space at maximum velocity. The docking bay area was of considerable size. The explosive decompression had thrown it into utter disarray. Half-glimpsed dock servitors, loading vehicles, cargo crates, even cartwheeling personnel came spinning at them, carried by the riptide of escaping air. Some of them were on fire. A small, lighter craft tumbled at them, snagged off a crane gantry, inverted, and met the starboard boom of the charging Caestus. The ram tore it in two, and it shredded back and away over the ram's drive section. The mangled boat bounced and rebounded off the dock ceiling, wing pieces and engine blocks disintegrating and scattering. Terek 810's blind cannon blast had gouged the interior of the bay, turning another two moored shuttles to molten slag. Two or three of the micro-warheads had also gone into the hangar, unimpeded by any obstacles. They detonated deep inside as they finally met solid objects. The Caestus tore through the gantry frame of a cargo loader, folding the girders and scaffolded structure around itself like a garland. The dragged framework ripped two small landers from their ceiling rack moorings. The Caestus had almost run out of space. The far end of the docking bay was another gate hatch. Automatically triggered, blast-proof door skins were closing across the scored and grubby hatch. Terek 810 fired the cannon, roasting a spear of energy out in front of the Caestus. The afterburners had finished their jolt, but the pilot servitor fired them again, using reserve fuel, grabbing a last little bit of force and momentum. The inner doors did not explode. They buckled under the melter fire, forming pustules and scabs of molten chrome that spalled flakes of metal like dead skin. Still trailing shreds of twisted girderwork behind it like streamers, the Caestus hit the inner doors. Now they exploded. The impact stove the doors in. It folded one horizontally and punched it clean out of the hatch frame. The other, weakened more extensively than the first by the melter damage, ruptured like wet paper or damaged tissue, spattering the Caestus with superheated liquid metal. The Caestus came through the doors into the secondary dock, bringing most of them with it. It had lost a considerable amount of momentum. Part of its port wing had been stripped away by the collision. Stability was impaired. Further explosive decompression caused gale force crosswinds to wrestle with the heavy craft. The prow shields that had protected it thus far had finally burned out and failed. It was more projectile than vehicle. It bore on, demolishing one after another, three lighter shuttles that were suspended side by side above the dock floor and mooring clamps. Terek 810 saw sensor displays that told him the Reach's vast atmospheric processors were running at hyperactive levels as they attempted to compensate for the catastrophic pressure loss. Field generators were fighting to establish a cordon against hard space and seal the deep, gaping wound in the Reach's environmental integrity. That was good. The archenemy was too concerned about retaining its environment to consider the consequences. Atmospheric stability meant the Imperial Guard components following the Caestus in would be able to deploy directly. The Caestus was almost out of room in the secondary bay. Terek 810 fired the Magna Melta again and softened the end of the compartment enough to stab the ram ship through it. The boom arms punched through the hull plate, rock infill and inner skin compartment lining. This time, it left most of its other wing behind. Clipped and injured, ceramite armour blackened with firewash and molten metal, it tore through into the next chamber, an engineering depot. Almost all of its effective momentum had been robbed away. Terek 810 stabilised the shuddering craft, slamming it sideways into the casing of a bulk processor as he fought it to a halt. He pulled the lever that dropped the boarding ramps.
"For the Emperor!"
he howled in an amplified, augmetic monotone.
"Kill them!"
Telltale lights on his main console showed him that down in the transport compartment, three inertial suppression clamps had been released.